for argument this morning is Jenkins against Bartlett. Mr. Nunn.
Thank you. May it please the court and Ms. Lappin. The plaintiff will begin its argument today with arguments three and four, principally the Monell claim. This court in Powell versus the City of Chicago has indicated that liability for fault on an individual is when the individual officially breaks with policy. Conversely, when an official performs his duty according to established policy or practice, municipal liability attaches. What we have in this case, and I turn the court particularly to Appendix 18 and 19, there are essentially two competing bulletin trainings, one on vehicle contacts and or stops. In particular with respect to 18 and 19, if you look on page 19, there is a diagram relating to vehicle contacts describing what is called the kill zone in the rear, in the back, and also on the sides. Essentially, what is articulated in this case is that because of Appendix 18 and 19, since the shootings of Reyes in 1997 and Antonio Davis, there has existed officers constantly getting within the kill zone.
I don't follow you. What is the matter with 18 and 19?
18 and 19, the preamble of the policy requires that officers not place themselves in danger, right, not place themselves in front of the vehicles.
Right. But so what is your problem? I don't understand you.
The problem is, with respect to a number of cases, one, the Antonio Davis shooting, two, the Reyes shooting, all of the officers got into the kill zone.
Look, I don't know what you're driving at. If you want to make a Monell argument, you want to show that the city itself is complicit, you know, in this behavior by the police officers. Well, this 18 and 19, this training bulletin looks perfectly unexceptionable, right? Nothing
and we can see that it is constitutional.
So fine. That's fine. So what's the problem?
What's the problem is, from that time period until the time of shooting, there had been a number of shootings that had obviously not been in compliance with the policy. And what we're saying is that the city had constructive knowledge about that danger. Consistent with the City of Oklahoma versus Tunnels, there existed a number of those incidents. One, utilizing the theory articulated in the case of Harris, and what we're relying on that line of cases, did the city have a constitutional obligation or duty to make sure that there was proper police servicing? That is the concern. We also believe that, hypothetically, and I'm asking the court to consider this, what really existed in Milwaukee from Reyes until the time of the Justin Fields shooting, when an officer kills someone either through vehicle contact or it was then sent to the district attorney's office. The district attorney's office, through the inquest process, made a finding.
Henry, I'm puzzled by all of this. The arguments about vicarious liability of the city go nowhere unless there's primary liability, and the district court found there was no primary liability. So aren't you rather getting ahead of matters?
I think in terms of there being primary liability, what I'm saying to the court on the Monell argument is, with respect to the failure to implement and implement acceptable practices and policies. Did the city under Monell...
You're missing the point, Mr. Connery.
Yes, sir.
There was a jury trial in this case. The jury found that there was no violation of the Constitution. There can't be vicarious liability without primary liability. And therefore, one would think you need to start with the question of primary liability.
But the course law, as I understand the case law, there was never a decision on summary judgment with respect to allowing the city in on Monell in the first place. And what I'm arguing in argument number 3 and 4 is to whether those, the city and the chief, should have been in. It is allegations as to whether the city's actions or inactions or omissions could have led to a liability. And we're suggesting that the city's actions and inactions could have led to liability. Then, with respect to the other Monell prong of this argument, the failure to train, what we're saying here in the failure to train, basically, had the MD, the Milwaukee police, vested the police officers with carte blanche authority without giving them adequate training. And what we're relying upon here, simply...
pursuing what Chief Judge Easterbrook was saying, is your argument that even if Bartlett did not use excessive force, the city is liable for not having trained him, or what?
We're getting to that one, yes. What we're saying also that...
What do you say you're getting to that one? You know, we have held that there is no liability for bad training or bad policies if there was no underlying unconstitutional act by the public official.
There was an underlying constitutional act, but should that have been...
The jury ruled in Bartlett's favor, so you need to start with that issue.
Okay, and I'm assuming arguendo that there could, as I understand Monell, there doesn't have to be a constitutional violation, and perhaps I'm wrong on that.
You are.
And what I'm saying here then, and I'd just like to make this point, had Bartlett been trained on Appendix 18 and 19, had there been the adequacy of the training with respect to the Appendix 18 and the kill zone, from Reyes until Bartlett, this would not have occurred. What we are essentially saying is he did not have that training. And what we're relying upon here is the following, that the preamble of Appendix 18 and Appendix 35, it would be an officer's advantage to flanking. Prior to Bartlett, there was the killing of Victor Rodriguez. And in the Rodriguez killing, it was done by a Sandoval. Mr. Bartlett, in his testimony, in the record, at Bartlett's transcript 157, P1, describes that he did not fully understand the flanking. He also indicated that he had no retraining. There was also the shooting after Bartlett, that is the Justin Fields shooting, was asked about the training bulletin. I don't recall. Has anyone given you any training regarding shooting in vehicles? He didn't recall. So what is happening from the time of Reyes until the time of Justin Fields, we find that there was a sense of inadequate training. The shooting death of Justin Fields in 32805. Sandoval, that testimony is located at transcript pages 21:5-19. When asked about the word flanking, he's saying, yes, I don't recall exactly how that's used. That is the shooting prior to Jenkins. And essentially what the plaintiff appellant is saying, that this inadequacy and this deficiency in the training, this is sufficient evidence for an inference at least can be drawn that he was not adequately trained. Shifting gears to the expert analysis, We believe that the court should pay particular attention.
Mr. Nunnery, where can we find the district court's rulings on the admissibility of this evidence?
I think it's described in my brief.
Your brief contains certification under Circuit Rule 30 that all materials required to be in the appendix are there, but none of the district court's rulings at trial concerning evidence is in your appendix.
Well, at any rate, I'm sorry for that, and if I would need
leave. This is not your first violation of Rule 30.
Okay. With respect to the arguments in RS 73, page 6, I'm asking that the court will take notice of the bullets. And as I understand it, Your Honor, you are saying the transcript or the trial transcripts that were actually ordered are not in the record. We ask that the court look at RS 73, page 6, and particularly S11 and S12. There were essentially four rods that paralleled the windshield, and when the rods went into the car, it identified the path of the bullets. We're also asking that the court take notice of Plaintiff Exhibit 156.018, and 156.007, 156.005. And essentially, the theory here is, was Jenkins ever accelerating or driving the vehicle? We believe that that was not the case. We believe that the trial judge, if Jenkins was in fact behind the steering wheel, driving the car, this probably would have been qualified immunity. And we believe that the court was in error. There was no report in compliance with that summary, with that admissibility issue. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Lappin.
Good morning, Your Honors. To begin, I believe that is correct that in this matter, the underlying case received a full trial, 2-week trial in front of a jury. That jury made a determination that the officer did not use excessive force when he shot Mr. Jenkins. Given that determination of constitutionality, I believe the Monell issues are moot. And
well, you reversed your argument the same in the brief the same way he did. Also, I don't understand you. You don't have a statement of facts. You refer us to a district court opinion for the facts.
It was the district court's summary of the facts that the court
determined. It is a jury trial, right?
Correct.
So then you're supposed to state the facts in a way that's, you know, supported by the verdict. It's very foggy what the facts are.
With reference to the issues that were raised on appeal, those factual matters, as they were discussed during the course of the trial, were summarized with reference to the trial record. With reference to the
you're supposed to do your own statement of facts. What do you think are the facts, you know, consistent with the verdict?
Correct. And with the issues that were raised by the appellant in this matter, there were references to the trial court.
Well, the basic question is whether Bartlett used excessive force. That's the basic question.
But that issue was not, or that question was not appealed before this court.
Well, he certainly argued. Well, it's not. The brief is unclear. He's certainly
correct.
Arguing that Bartlett used excessive force.
And that was part of the problem in deciphering.
Pardon? He is arguing that Bartlett used excessive force.
My reading of the appellant's brief did not indicate that they were challenging the jury's determination that the officer...
They're challenging the admissibility of evidence and asking for a new trial on that question. That's the whole point of challenging rulings on the admissibility of evidence.
With reference to the matters surrounding the use of force itself, the events of that evening, I did not perceive that the appellant was challenging those facts. The facts as brought
Look,
before the jury.
You have to state the facts of the case so that the court has a picture of what happened. What Bartlett did is obviously related to the issue of training and so on. But I have a question about the privilege issue. I don't understand how attorney-client privilege somehow embraces the union official. I understand the union lawyer, but why the president, the local, whatever he was?
Correct. In this particular situation, as is typical of police-involved shooting matters, the president of the police union assists the union attorney, Mr. Simelli, in making arrangements relative to obtaining a room where the attorney can meet with the client, the officer, before the officer
is
compelled.
Well, the lawyer's secretary assists the lawyer. Does that mean that the secretary has the attorney-client privilege?
I believe so. If the actions of the secretary are to further the attorney-client interaction and the attorney-client relationship, I believe so. If it's simply to arrange.
Well, that's too vague. That's too vague. So how do we know what do we know exactly what the what the union official said?
With regard to the record that was before the trial court, testimony was elicited from Mr. DeBrasca and Attorney Cermelli, and Mr. DeBrasca had indicated that he was not present for any specific conversations between Mr. Cermelli and the officer. Rather, he was present in the building that day to facilitate the room to obtain any documentation that the attorney thought he might need relative to his meeting with the client and so forth. There was no indication that Mr. DeBrasca was, in fact, present for the attorney-client conversation.
I don't understand how you're answering my question. What was the ruling on his privilege, the union official's privilege?
The ruling of the court was that the official, that the attorney-client privilege covered the actions of Mr. DeBrasca.
Look, what is it the union official, what is it that the plaintiff wanted to ask the union official that the judge said was within the privilege?
I believe what he wanted to ask was whether or not the union official overheard conversations between the attorney and the client regarding the events of the evening.
Yes, and?
And that the attempt would be to try to elicit that information through the union official if the information could not be elicited directly from either Mr. Bartlett or his attorney.
So you're saying the only thing they wanted from the union official was what Bartlett had said to the lawyer.
Correct.
Now, why isn't the union official's presence as a third party, why doesn't that destroy privilege?
Because in this instance, in this factual setting.
Why is someone who is not a lawyer overhearing a conversation between a lawyer and a client?
Because in this instance, the activities of Mr. DeBrasco were acting as an agent for Attorney Cermelli relative to facilitating the attorney-client information.
Well, now you've lost me completely.
Yeah, why is this an attorney-client privilege at all as opposed to a work product privilege?
Because of the fact that there are communications between Mr. Cermelli and Mr. Bartlett prior to Mr. Bartlett giving a statement to investigators during the evening or early morning hours of the shooting. And because it's communications between the attorney and the client, the client attorney-client privilege was asserted.
But apparently not for the purpose of getting legal advice. It was the purpose of preparing for litigation. That's why I'm asking about the work product privilege.
I'm sorry, as far as my relationship with my client or Mr. Cermelli?
No.
That Mr. Cermelli was preparing for working with his client in preparing his client for giving statements to criminal investigators. That would be the first formal statement that was given subsequent to the shooting incident. And Mr. Cermelli was giving counsel, giving advice to his client.
So why is there a third person who is not a lawyer present?
He is there simply to, and the testimony is that he was not in the room during the course of the heart of any conversations. He may have passed through, but he indicated that he did not overhear a specific conversation.
Well, I don't understand. First you say he's the privilege.
Right.
Means that he doesn't have to repeat anything he heard.
Correct.
Now you say he didn't hear anything, which would make the privilege issue moot.
Well, as he was Mr. DeBrasca's statement when there was an offer of proof made had indicated that his involvement being in the room was very limited, that he was only present to facilitate the interaction. He did
what
not
does
himself
that mean, to facilitate the interaction?
Get an interview room in the detective bureau to allow the two people to be able to speak behind closed doors without any other people present.
If it's behind closed doors without anybody present, then he didn't overhear anything.
But there were opportunities for him to bring information to Mr. Cermelli, any documentation.
Well, wait a second. Well, that's interesting. Bring information? So what's privileged about that?
What the privilege was asserted was any conversation that was had between Mr. Cermelli and Mr. Bartlett. Should Mr. Tabraska have overheard any of that information in the course of acting as Mr. Cermelli's agent, it was asserted
what
that those...
What acting as his agent? What does that mean? What's he doing in the room with the when the lawyer is interviewing the client?
Allowing the attorney and providing the attorney with whatever he needed to be able to provide advice and counsel to the client. Whether it be in the meeting, to get a place for the meeting, get any reports that have been generated about the underlying events up to that point in time.
Well, he can testify, can't he, about any reports he got for anyone, right? Couldn't
that
he?
Was not the intended purpose of his testimony to be elicited. It was my understanding, and it was pretty clear at her trial, that what was attempted to be elicited was the communication between the client and Attorney Cermelli relative to this preparation for this interview that was about to take place. And in any event, with reference to the information, the defendant asserts that even if the privilege did not apply in this particular situation, that the communications relative to preparing the witness for an interview that night would be hearsay, would not be relevant beyond that point with reference to the matter being considered by the jury, which was the underlying issue of whether or not the officer used excessive force. The jury was presented with the written statements which were generated as a result of the criminal investigation interview. They were also presented with other documentation regarding other statements given by the officer, and also had access to, and I believe there was testimony from some of the individuals who participated in questioning the officer to determine the statements that he gave that night, should they be weighed in any event in their evaluation of the witness, of the officer.
And why was Bartlett in front of the car?
Your Honor, he was in front of the car because as he was approaching and broke out from the alley into the roadway, he observed what he appeared or concluded was a carjacking in process. This person that had been fleeing from him had entered into the intersection, was going into a vehicle that was stopped at the intersection as if it were stopped for a stop sign. As the officer was approaching, he observed some kind of activity between the driver of the vehicle and Mr. Jenkins. Then suddenly he saw that the driver of the vehicle was not visible from his perspective above the steering wheel. The officer believed that this driver was in danger, that something was going on here. He brought his path. He was coming from to the driver's side of the vehicle, or excuse me, from the passenger side of the vehicle. He began then to turn toward the driver's side of the vehicle to go to the aid of the driver. At about that point in time when he's in front of the vehicle, that is when he observed Mr. Jenkins behind the steering wheel. And that's how he ended up in front of the vehicle.
Why didn't he go behind?
Because of the exigencies of the circumstances. It was a split-second decision that he made. His first motive and his first concern was to come to the aid of that person who he believed was having their car hijacked by Mr. Jenkins to further Mr. Jenkins'
Well, you could go
effort.
Around the back. It would be only an extra foot, right?
I don't think it would be an extra foot. It would be the length of the vehicle plus the distance.
No. If you're standing, was he standing next to the passenger door?
No, he wasn't. His testimony
was
coming from an angle. If you're in the car in the passenger's front passenger seat, he's at an angle to the right. So he's coming from an area in front of the car, running to the car,
and why
across
was he
the
in
intersection.
Front of the car? That was my question originally.
Initially, he was chasing Mr. Jenkins, coming to the passenger side. As he was approaching the vehicle from the front, Mr. Jenkins moved across the front seat of the vehicle to the driver's side. When the officer observed what appeared to be a struggle and then lost sight of the driver altogether, he veered to go around to the driver's side of the vehicle.
I understand. Thank you.
And he found himself in that position.
You could have said that in your brief, you know.
I apologize, Your Honor. And in any event, with regard to the circumstances, I believe that the evidence of record does indicate and is consistent with the factual summary that the court had presented in summary judgment. Also, Your Honors, with reference to the training issue as it relates to Monell, I do want to make one point in that the Milwaukee Police Department is not deliberately indifferent in its training regarding use of force, use of deadly force relative to police incidents involving motor vehicles. The bulletins that were referred to were training bulletins. They give guidance to the officer. The officers are clearly trained that they can only use deadly force in matters involving a subject in a motor vehicle when otherwise they would be allowed to use deadly force. And that's when they believe that their life, the life of another, or that they is in danger, or that they or another is an imminent threat of bodily harm. And I think that was quite true in this particular matter. The training bulletins took another step to give officers some idea of how these situations can arrive when they're acting out on the street. Training bulletins give guidance. They further expand upon the rules and procedures. The officers can only be trained so much in the classroom setting, and again, the training bulletins try to help them apply the classroom learned information to real-life applications out in the field, which quickly unfold and cause an officer to make split-second decisions. And, Your Honors, in this particular case, I think that regardless of, I believe that the privilege does apply, but regardless of that bit of information, that the verdict of the jury is still valid, that that verdict must be upheld, and, of course, the ultimate judgment of the court dismissing this matter. With regard to the Monell claim, I believe that clearly the police department has and does provide the officers with good training, constitutional training, training which is not deliberately indifferent to prepare officers for encountering these very dangerous situations when they go out in the field and work each day. And if there are no further questions from the court, I'll end my presentation. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Ms. Lappin. Anything further, Mr. Nunnery?
Judge Easterbrook, with respect to the transcript record, the docket sheet transcript 199-200 is the court's ruling with respect to Nebraska, the police union. With respect to the trial transcript on the Rule 702, that is in docket transcript 203. Those items were certified as being sent here to the Court of Appeals on 7-26-06. So I think that those documents are indeed in the record. With respect to the privilege issue, and the court should understand this, from the time of the shooting until about 11 o'clock that evening of the 19th, Mr. Bartlett was in the midst of his attorney and the police union. The police union is very powerful in Milwaukee. What they were doing was gathering information, conferring about it from 6:30 until about 10:50, time of him making his initial statement.
Ms. Lappin said that the only thing that you wanted from the president of the union was what he had conversation he had overheard between Bartlett and the lawyers.
That is absolutely incorrect. And what the record will indicate is this: it was more than that. It was the first attempt to prepare Bartlett to give a statement in internal affairs.
No. My question is, what did you want? What testimony did you want from the union president?
Basically, his demeanor.
What did you want him to talk about? What was the subject?
Did you aid and assist Mr. Bartlett in preparing for his internal affairs? Had you gathered information from other detectives and investigators and shared that with him before the investigation?
And the judge didn't permit you to ask that question?
He didn't permit any of that. And that transcript will highlight it. We believe that argument of embellishing and preparing him went directly to Mr. Bartlett's credibility and to the whole issue in the case. And with respect to the 702 ruling, see, my time is up.
Thank you, Mr. Nunnery.
Thank you.
The case is taken under advisement.